Yes. Yes.
There's also the question of not realising why some things are important, you know, and realise that they were, you know, because other people have different interests.
Would but, you?
We got on to Sicily.
Well, I was just wondering at what stage it ran out. Well, anyway, just to recap extremely quickly, she married a very charming, handsome young Irishman who, in fact, was a centre three-quarter, what's the other name for it? I can't remember, rugger, for Oxford, even Oxford, yes. Rugger blue.
Yes.
And that was a very, very inside. Happy marriage. Mm. They had an elder daughter, Jennifer, who now lives a half a mile away. Then a little boy who very tragically died in about 1922-23, I think a month or two after Sir Julian, who was, that was a pretty tragic death. I mean, he was only about 50. And the little Reuben died, I'm pretty damn sure, looking back, it was always supposed that he died of pneumonia. I think he must have died of undiagnosed diphtheria. Right. If a child has diphtheria in its throat where the doctor doesn't see it, when he looks down, the child can die of heart failure with, you know, just go out like a light.
So anyway,
and then there was a younger daughter, Tabitha. And Bridget, and then I think after Reuben died, I think the youngest one was born. But anyway, they had four children, but the tragic loss of their only son, and they had three daughters. So there were seven grandchildren. We all lived over in Woodgate. But as there were usually some other children, there were usually about nine children in the house.
Can you say anything about your mother's relationship with her brother and sister?
Great devotion. I remember my mother saying slightly bitterly once about Adrian in relationship to my father. God knows how it had arisen. He has all the contempt of a successful man for the unsuccessful. But I think Adrian and my father got on very well. I mean, they were brothers-in-law, and I never heard my father. It's the only thing my father said unkindly about Adrian, which was quite true, was that money meant far too much. I remember Adrian once called me into his study there. Said, look here, you come and live here. This was after his father and my grandfather died, and you don't even pay for your laundry. Well, of course, having been brought up as I was, I wasn't really aware that one paid for laundry. As far as I was concerned, a shirt was dirty and somebody whisked it away and it turned up again. I mean, I was only too delighted to pay, that sort of thing. But father was a little bit like that, but I never knew Uncle, never heard Uncle Adrian say anything. As I said, it was an extraordinarily harmonious family.
What about Sicily? Did she get on well with Sicily?
It was pronounced Sicily.
Sicily.
No. I mean, I think it's spelt identically.
It's
because
Sicily, and I never know why it's
because the Nita McCall, who married Adrian, you know, the brother. Had a younger sister who is called Sicily.
I see.
And it's pronounced Sicily, but she was Sicily. I think it's just the Irish way of pronouncing it. It was a very, very happy family, and my parents were often, but there was never the faintest question of, we don't want to go to Woodgate because Adrian's there. There was nothing like that.
No, fine.
I've never had any.
I'm rather surprised. You mentioned, I think, well, maybe it was you who mentioned Dr. Ashby, her being upset when her mother died. But surely the relationship with her father was very close as well, wasn't it? I mean, how did.
Yes. Immensely devoted to him, but I think not quite in the same way. I mean, her father was a marvellous old chap. tiny in stature but immensely wise, and people would tread for miles across the country to come and consult him about things. I mean, working men with him,
right.
Knowing he was a trained lawyer and businessman and local squire and heaven knows what else. But I don't have any conscious memory of her particularly wearing black. Mm-hmm. And after all, you see, her mother died earlier. Mm. And as I say, she'd been terribly close with her, and literally writing to each other every day, a monumental effort.
Yeah.
Leaving him as a rather lonely old widower, older than Granny had been anyway, and surviving another 5 years. So in some ways, and please don't misunderstand it, she almost let her father go like I let my mother go. At the end of a life, a wonderful life, dying without suffering.
Right.
I mean, one is almost, it wasn't a tragic death, I think that puts the context how old Charles...
Right, yes. On the other hand, it's a pity she didn't make 100, isn't it? Did she not want
to? No, she didn't want to. Oh, Lord, it was pricelessly funny. Really? At her 99th birthday, and she was already sufficiently old to be a little bit irritable, one or two of our young relatives and friends and various people came in, and I remember one or two of them said, by the time the second lot had said many happy returns of the day, she couldn't resist saying, I don't want another day, please don't wish me to. Oh no, she didn't want to hit the 100. There was no shred of sense of wanting to hit the 100, get a telegram from the Queen or any of that. No, no, she really would have preferred to have quit out at about the 97 mark.
Really? Really?
In fact, earlier still, she even said she didn't want to go on living once father had gone, and she felt she was beginning to be a bit of a burden to Pam and that sort of thing. We didn't. Anyway, I think that puts square the business about her not being upset when her father died. We all, I think, felt that I think he'd hit the 80 mark, you see.
In general about her career, I think that it's a sort of indictment, really, of British politics that they couldn't have found room for her somewhere. That is, she ought to have been in the House of Lords, wouldn't she? Really, I mean, she was such a good speaker and so expert.
Yes,
so
I think probably really they did. But of course, you see, there weren't many liberals. Mm. She was not only a liberal, but a bit sometimes was not above speaking out against the establishment if she thought it was wrong. And I suppose the House of Lords in those days. And you see, during the period when it would have been suitable to put her into the House of Lords, I'm not at all sure that this life, you know, the sort of life peer business, I'm not sure it had hardly started.
It started in 58, actually.
When did she get her DBE?
Until 67. Oh, really? It's later, yeah. Was it? Really, I'm surprised.
She refused it, you see.
I didn't know that, really.
She was offered it by Sir John Simon, wasn't she?
I'm not quite sure what she was offered.
That's what she told me. I don't know what she was offered, but she was offered a...
She was... Pam's right. I mean, she was unquestionably offered an honour at the end of the disarmament conference.
Oh, yes,
but
she
felt
so
that the British
that
delegation... it was largely Ramsay MacDonald's fault. He was an appalling Prime Minister. And
there's a lot in that collection of yours about that, actually.
And she said, of course, the terrible thing was that we've had bad Prime Ministers and we've had bad Foreign Secretaries, but hardly ever in the hundreds of years of British history have we ever had a really bad Prime Minister and a really bad Foreign Secretary at the same time.
Oh, yes, right.
She admired Simon in many ways. On one occasion, something unexpected arose in the conference, and Simon, I think, who was quite fond of my mother, and that, and I think admired her, turned round and said, can you give me a few points about this? So my mother furiously scribbled four or five things, handed it to him, and he made the most beautiful speech, putting it right. Oh, yeah, no, he was a marvellously, fantastically successful barrister. Ready, yes. But as she pointed out, he had to be told what to do. And then, she said it was actually an admirable speech, and the fellow really had, he literally was handed a scribble with five points on it. But as far as understanding the problems of the emergent Germany, I don't know if this is of interest to you, but on one occasion the German, the head German delegate, I think it was Baron von Neurath, but if it wasn't Baron von Neurath, it was a very, very charming German, Baron von Rheinbarben, I remember, but I think it was von Neurath, came along and said to Simon and the British delegation, you must give me, they were discussing, of course, disarmament of Britain and France and Germany having no armaments at all. And von Neurath said, look, you must give me something to take home to my people, or there will follow events the end of which no man can tell. This was a, this you see was just at the time of the rising of Hitler.
Right. Actually, your mother's speeches, she gave a lot of speeches at the International Alliance and other bodies in the 30s, and they get more and more depressed every year that goes by. Yes. Her speeches are admirable.
But the interesting thing about this was that the terrible moment that it was, Simon, having no instructions from Ramsay MacDonald, and also the British Air Minister was Lord Londonderry, who was such a nitwit, he really couldn't remember more than one single point at a time. I mean, as opposed to Simon, the man was a complete BF. And von Neurath got a completely non-committal home-lit answer, and my mother said that von Neurath went absolutely white and walked away. And within a few months, there was Hitler. Now, I'm not, of course, saying, nor did Mama, that this could have held up the Hitler business, but it might have, And in another appalling occasion which shook her to the ground was that at the time of the invasion of Abyssinia, when there was more and more people in Britain were getting outraged at the way the Italians were massacring and using gas and bombing aeroplanes and everything else against Abyssinia, in spite of the wretched League of Nations, my mother actually overheard Simon, who was walking up the stairs with somebody else at some great reception, turn to whoever he was walking with and saying, we must not let Mussolini down. This was Britain's foreign policy, that although in all the newspapers and all that sort of thing was howling against Mussolini, Mussolini was anti-communist, we mustn't let him down. And the same attitude in respect of Hitler, really, in those days. Hitler was a blue-eyed boy who was anti-Russian.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons.
Didn't matter how many Jews went into the cooker.
You asked me why I sort of admired your mother a lot. I mean, she took on almost every issue just the sort of line I hope I would have taken if I'd been there. I mean, she was extraordinarily right in the 30s about it.
Oh, yes, she thought, thought very deeply about things. And, of course, she lived in an atmosphere of where, you know, she was meeting the sort of people who were also having, as it were, your sort of ideas. And this is how the Townswomen's Guild.
Right.
I don't say my mother thought of it. I don't know who did think
well,
of
it. Well, it was her.
I don't know, she and one or two others thought of it. And then, of course, this is where she came into her own with her pep and drive. She and this one other woman.
Eva Hubbard.
got it going.
No, that's.
But I expect you got in the various interviews that you've had with her, all the foreign bodies that she came, foreign principals that she came in contact with,
yes.
Danish and the Greek ones.
Oh, and the Turkish one, Atatürk and so on.
Fascinating, yes.
By the way, there's something you can tell me better than anybody, really. She had very good health, didn't she?
Yes, tremendously good health.
I mean,
yes.
People's health is so good.
I virtually never remember her being ill.
I mean, you said she may have had a miscarriage, but that's...
I mean, that puts you to bed for a couple of days, isn't it?
Yes.
That's all I can personally agree.
Hardly ever caught a cold. I think she always said she never had flu.
And she had sort of stamina and zest about her.
Oh, yes, tremendous.
So I always remember she fell off a bus, didn't she, about 93 in Hampstead or somewhere. I mean,
I've got a photograph, I must look it out somewhere. I hope it's a photo, not a colour slide, though you can get them, of her sawing wood.
Really?
Great barrow. In fact, I've got two or three of them. Well, one of which was, must have been she was 97, and certainly another one when she was 95 or 96, with a great barrow load of logs.
Really? Yeah. Well, you rather surprised me when you said she didn't like dogs. I mean, there's that photograph of her with all those geese, for instance. Did she not?
She liked animals.
She liked animals.
She did, didn't she?
And all all dogs thought that she was a cat's whiskers.
Oh, really?
She always used to say, they love me so much.
But in fact, when we had a miniature dachshund and it had some puppies, she had...
We gave her one of the puppies
and she was devoted to it.
Really?
She behaves if she was.
Yeah, she doesn't like them her, but she was... quite ridiculous with this stupid little animal, wasn't she?
And she was fond of the geese. I know, she was
She gets very attached to anything, and I think she was afraid of her, or I could say, almost dividing her loyalties between a dog and a grandpa or something.
Right,
like that.
But, yes.
In fact, she wasn't very fond of them, she tolerated them.
Now, before I forget, there are two other things. I'm not sure I haven't forgotten them already. Oh, yes, there are... She had two very interesting psychic experiences, which I think you might be interested in. But I must also, I did, sitting in the bath a couple of nights ago, remember, in the strange way one does under odd conditions, an astonishing thing which happened to her when during this period when she was in the First World War at Lowestoft. There was a very intense blackout. And I suppose she knew her way about, but it's an extraordinary story. Anyway, she was walking along a pavement on her way home or going somewhere, and there were two sailors walking, holding hands in the other direction, and none of the three heard the others coming. And the first thing my mother knew was that two enormous arms went across her thighs and she went clean over onto her face in the road. And I don't know which of the three were more flabbergastedly astonished. I think the sailors were appalled, but at any rate, I think they picked her up and sorted it out. And after that, she bought a small luminous button. But this was a rather strange... slightly comic, and she wasn't badly hurt.
Slightly surrealist. Sort
but, gee God, but when you picture the degree of the blackout, the two large sailors, I think they must have been fairly short for their hands to be low enough, but I suppose they were steering each other probably in a somewhat zigzag course back from the pub to their ship.
What was the second incident?
There was another tidbit which I just remembered from Lowestoft. Some German battle cruisers or heavy cruisers turned up off Lowestoft and started bombarding the town. And I was, my mother was obviously a bit anxious about the shell fire, but I sat up in bed and every time the shells came in I said, bumpity bump.
Yes, I think she told me
that. Enormously enjoyed it.
Yes, yes.
But on another occasion, talking about Norris, I was in with her in East Putney Station, where there was an enormous long flight of concrete steps, and a porter lost control of two or three empty milk churns, which came down these, rolled down these steps, and my mother looked towards me, and there was I watching with a look of absolute ecstatic enjoyment, and really the most lovely noise I'd ever heard. But a Norwegian, it reminds me of two other things. I don't think that's terribly relevant, but I must get them off my chest
yes,
for my memoirs. A great Norwegian friend of our, of the family, they'd originally met through the family's connection fishing in Bergen, because this girl's father had been the engineer who built the great railway from Bergen to Oslo. And on one occasion, this lady who worked as an ambulance driver for the French ambulances during the war as a volunteer and got some quite high French decoration. Anyway, after the war, some orphan child was put into her care to take, she volunteered to take it to Paris for some reason or other. And she arrived at Dover and duly got onto the boat and arrived in presumably Calais or Dunkirk or whatever. And the man said, to passport, please hand the passport. And the baby's passport, and of course it had never occurred to her or any of the people sending this baby out that the baby needed a passport. So she said, oh, well, there's no passport for a baby. And the man said, well, the baby can't come in without a passport. And so she picked the child up and put it down on the man's, counter and walked on. And there was a sort of, she'd only gone about 10 steps when there was a stifled cry of horror from the man who rushed after her, handed her back the baby, and that was the last that was seen of that.
Is that your mother?
Yeah. No, this was Helga Gill. But we thought that was a very ditty, but that would go into my
did she? Did your mother actually, you said she woke up early in the mornings, but did she go to bed early at night? I mean,
No.
I vaguely remember you saying she used to sit up and read or something.
I would have thought 10, half past 10 or 11 was the sort of time
yes.
that they would go to bed.
Yes.
She would.
Yes,
she
even
would
after
get,
her husband died.
But she would sleep badly, and she would get up, as Pam said, from... Well, her parents, the whole of their married life in this great big, and it was unusual in a great British country house, breakfast was sharp at 8:30 in the morning, and everybody was expected to be on time for breakfast. I don't mean to say that, if you turn up at 2:55, but you weren't expected to sort of drift in at
no just out of consideration.
But I remember my mother once saying about my father that I'd been irritated the whole of my life by his getting up late and coming down late for breakfast. Father was not a good getter-upper. Mm. I mean, obviously, if he had an important, if he had work,
yes.
You know, in the sense of a draper's thing or pensions appeal, he wouldn't be late for a job like that. But, he wasn't a good getter up in the morning. Now, the two psychic experiences, I think, are very interesting.
I wonder if she told you those.
Not that I remember. I want to ask about religion anyway, actually.
Well, I'll tell you, the first one is, I think, the more interesting, though the second is more directly in the family. My mother was about 17 and she went to stay in a very old country house somewhere in the Midlands, but that's irrelevant, and with some rather distant friends or something. Anyway, she went to bed. It was a biggish house party. She went to bed and woke up in the middle of the night with the sense that there was someone in the room, because I, as you know, she was very sensitive about those things, and opened her eyes and looked down, and standing just below, just beyond the foot of her bed, was an old man dressed in rather strange clothes, with a very kindly, benevolent face. And my mother was absolutely terrified and clutched the bedclothes and said to myself, I won't scream, I won't scream. And was particularly noted, but of course naturally reflexy like you do, looking at the person's face. And noticed what a kindly face it was. And then after, I don't know what length of time, I imagine probably pretty short, he just disappeared. Mm. So my mother, to quote her own words, didn't sleep a wink for the rest of the night, and went down to breakfast next day, and her hostess said, good morning, Marjorie, I hope you slept well. And my father always said that my mother was the best liar he'd ever met, but this was an occasion when my mother didn't, she only lied when it was
white lies, yes.
But my mother didn't see any point in pretending she had, and told this story. And the hostess looked a bit puzzled, and then she looked thoughtful, got up from the breakfast table, went out, and about 5 minutes later came back from the library with a book, opened the book, showed my mother the picture, and that was the man.
Mm, who was it?
And this was from the days, and I don't know which it was, and it doesn't matter, either the days of Catholic persecution or Protestant persecution, one or other, and the family of the one or other persuasion had sheltered and hidden an elderly priest in their house for quite a number of years, and he had died in the house, and had the book about the house and the family with this picture of this man. And my mother took no interest in the occult or ghost stories or anything like that. But there was, to my mind, a completely authentic sort of virgin story of a ghost.
Mm. Mind you, if you look at it sort of rationally, they could have been talking about it, say, at dinner the night before, this priest or something.
No, they hadn't been.
And she had a dream.
Yes, no, apparently there wasn't any question. It was absolutely anyway, out of the blue.
What's the second incident?
In fact, this is why the hostess looked so thoughtful that, she started having to think frantically of who or what it could be, and then she suddenly remembered this story of Father so-and-so, and went out into the library and got...
Did that affect your mother's attitude
at all? She always said that she was no one to disbelieve in ghosts, and she thought that there probably were sort of occult sort of forces in the world, because she, before I tell you the other direct experience, she also had another reason she had for thinking and believing in this was that she'd had a friend who was living, at least I don't know if it was a friend now, I think it was more of an acquaintance in some poorish part of South London, who had become very keen on sort of black magic. I don't mean killing children, but black magic and calling up devils and things.
Yes.
And had become more and more obsessed with it, was living with another woman who I think in the end could stand it no longer and left. Anyway, she had a large dog. And on one occasion, this friend who came back to the house found her dead with a sort of ghastly expression of terror on her face and the various rigmaroles of the black magic rites. But the most interesting thing was that the dog was absolutely beside itself with terror. And my mother just merely commented, well, could she have called up something frightful? Anyway, my mother, without being interested, never read a book on it, never talked about it, but she just had that personal experience and then the very close knowledge of another thing, which, take it or leave it. Now, the other one, well, there is absolutely cast iron proof of thought, some kind of psychic transference, was that one day in Putney, my mother sat up in bed and said to my father, there's something wrong at Oundle. There was no question of any phone call or letter or anything. She got dressed, phoned for a taxi, drove in the taxi to Euston, and she would never take a taxi except in emergencies.
That's interesting.
Got in the first train from Euston, took a taxi from the station at Oundle, and as the taxi drew up outside the schoolhouse, the headmaster's door, the headmaster came out, white as a sheet, and said, Mrs. Ashby, thank God you've come.
Yeah. Can you were ill in some way.
I had just developed blood poisoning, septicemia, but the headmaster was in such a state because another boy had died of septicemia the day before. But there was no question of my mother knowing that the other boy had been very ill and had died of septicemia, nor did she know that I was ill. Well, take it or leave it, but how in God's name? So I also rather inclined to think on that basis. I've never had any psychic experiences myself, except that Pam and I sometimes uncannily think of the same thing at the same time.
Well, that's because you know each other so
well. Well, I think so.
Yes, I expect so.
Yes, but still it's pretty odd sometimes.
But what sort of a Christian was your mother, really? I mean, you say she went to communion regularly.
Yes.
She read religious books a lot. But, you know, you wouldn't...
I think she read the Desjardins books.
Yes. Did she read the Bible, for instance, regularly?
Yes.
She
read... Every night she read something before she went to sleep.
Really?
Yes. That's... Well, I know when I used to put her to bed in the last 2 years when I was down here, she always had a... Not that it wasn't the Bible, it was some other sort of that kind of a thing.
It was a collection of religious writings of some
sort. Like she always read something.
And she read the church, the parish magazine regularly, and she also took the Church Times and read that.
Did she?
And then she was very conscientious about reading the sort of International Women's News, which of course she'd been editor for countless years.
But long after. On a religious basis, she used to go, she took very seriously then.
Really?
And nearly always, until the very last years of her life, gave up something which she was very fond of for the whole 6 weeks, be it coffee, which she always loved, which meant she missed her mid-morning coffee.
Coffee or alcohol,
like
or both.
Yes.
And Philip Steamer's in alcohol.
And then go to a once-a-week religious, not talking isn't quite the right word, but over at Worth Abbey, where they would have different...
During Lent.
Well, only occasionally to Worth Abbey, but she would perhaps go more...
Yeah, to the village or somewhere. Yes.
Where does she belong? I mean, is she a high church, evangelical, or what?
She didn't mind it.
Thought that totally unimportant.
Yes.
She didn't care tuppence. I mean, over at Dane Hill, half the in my young day, half the congregation, if two candles were put on the altar, half the congregation would stay away. And if the poor wretched padre took the candles off, the other half would stay away and the one half would come. This may be a slight exaggeration.
I mean, I could see her being very impatient with that.
To her, she would thought Regardin was absolutely crazy.
Right.
She was keen on ecumenical. I mean, she
Even a Catholic church. I mean,
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
She's spoken, I think she's spoken in our local Catholic church, latterly, again, when the both movements became more united.
Really?
And she took the Women's Day of Prayer for the last, for quite a number of years down here in our local church, always.
I haven't followed up this aspect of her career, was she concerned about women priests and all that?
Yes.
She was
very disappointed that they were not allowed. That's why we asked Una Kroll, or we asked the others for her to come.
She gave a rather good talk, actually.
She would have so much liked to have seen her even in that state.
So, suppose you hadn't known that she was a deeply religious person, would you have guessed? And did she ever talk about religion? Because I don't remember.
No, she didn't.
No, but the answer is she could. And you'd find that she would go up to her, whereas perhaps some people would rather fight shy of going up to a religious body, as it were, you know, priest or bishop or whoever. She would go up with some interesting conversation which she'd like to learn about or something like that. Without hesitation, she'd be perfectly at home because she would be on the same ground.
Right.
She would know the different things that were going on. She took a lot of diocesan literature as well.
But I think whereas my father would have read a certain amount of theological stuff, I don't think my mother was interested in theology as such at all.
No, I can quite believe that.
That's practical, religious, just really the high principles of what you could call the primitive
practical Christianity,
Christian.
Really.
Yes.
Did she pray, actually, do you think?
Yes.
I mean, at night?
Yes.
Well, of course, I would have seen her too.
Again, she had these cousins, Mathesons, Margaret Matheson, who later joined her in the alliance and did a great deal with her, whose brother was a bishop, is Bishop of Calcutta or something like that.
He's head of a mission out there.
The whole family were what I call really thoroughly religious, right, you know, in every sort of aspect. Rather, you know it, you can't help knowing it. And Granny used to enjoy going to stay with them once a year or twice a year. And latterly, and towards the end, one of the daughters made her a little credo, because she said my knees are wearing out on the floor, and they padded her a little credo for the bedroom, which was up there. I know that was used.
But religion was never pushed on me. As a child, just like Pam brought up our four children to say their prayers in the evening, and I expect I did, but it was never pushed or expected. But I remember very late in life, almost her last 2 years, I remember her saying to me, with a little tiny touch of asperity or regret or something, that she, referring to Pamela, there are only two Christians in this house. I've never told anybody that before. But, I felt mildly knocked. I'm a practicing Christian, but I'm not I go to church solely because my wife wants me to. I find that. I don't mind going to church in conditions of adversity, you know what I mean.
Did she actually ever dislike anybody? Did she have some dislikes? I mean, I know she had a lot of friends, and was a much loved person, but did she? I don't want to over-sentimentalize.
She had no personal dislikes. But I think if she went anywhere near, like, I mean, I think she would have said that she disliked Sir John Simon because she felt...
Oh, right, well, with good reason, for political reasons.
Not because any way he treated her. Mm. I mean, he gave her a most glorious bound book of the story of San Michele with a very nice thing he'd written in it. But, I mean...
No, I really meant disliking people personally. I don't want you to say who she disliked. What I'm asking you is whether she ever did take dislikes to people.
No, I don't ever...
Well, she, then this must have been in her later years. She did mention to me once or twice the odd person.
Yes. What sort of people I know. Would she dislike?
Yes, I can
actually.
Tell you.
Pretentious
she had a... She, her other great friend, whom you've already mentioned, was Lady Daniel, Marjorie Daniel. Mm. And her son was very much, was to some extent brought up with me in the sense that she was my godmother and my mother was his godmother. Mm. And he was a very clever boy, was a scholar at Eton, and I think was getting on very well at Cambridge. And I can't remember whether he was still at Cambridge. I think he probably was, but I have no recollection of his getting any sort of degree, whereas his mother had got a first and his father got a double first. He then had an appalling motorcycle accident with brain injury on his motorbike in the Isle of Man, going round after the race, and another young chap went round the other way and they met. And after this, I think poor Nicholas did undergo a bit of a character change. Anyway, my mother was all the bitter about him for the way he treated his mother.
I see, yes.
But that's where she realised that that was character change.
But, yeah. Well, you could call that... So I think she did dislike Nicholas.
I
but there were no... He was never any sort of... It wasn't personal in the sense of... Oh, I don't like her. So,
no, it's just dislike of the
there
way
would have
he
to be
behaving.
A strong. Well, if there was a strong positive reason for actively disliking what somebody had done,
that's the same as Lord Simon. I mean, what I'm asking in a way is whether she instinctively disliked people in her personal relationships with them
at
ever.
All.
I mean,
and
or,
in fact,
and if
you
so,
could
what
see
sort
from
of
the
people?
Way I had frantically to rake up two people, and I've. Now can't think of anybody else, and as you say, both of them were for very good.
I can actually. I'm just rather interested to know whether it got through to you. I mean, there's a letter actually in your collection
well,
upstairs.
I know somebody locally that she couldn't stand.
Yes, lady.
I liked very much.
Yes.
She said she was so spiteful. She said I don't like her because she's very spiteful.
Mm. Yes, it would be objections to character,
yes,
really,
yes,
would it? Yes. It was Mrs. Ogilvy Gordon, actually. She wrote to your father in about 1922 saying, Mrs. Ogilvy Gordon's here and we both can't stand each other, you know. I mean, one doesn't
very
want...
Very few.
Yes, very few, I suspect. Yes, quite.
I think there must have been...
Oh, yes, and then there was Mrs. Aitken in the village.
Because she wouldn't be a human being if she didn't have some likes and dislikes. I mean,
but her dislike of Mrs. Aitken was only because Mrs. Aitken was always repeating rather gossipy things about,
yes.
About people. I mean, she was a great chatterbox, but Mrs. Aitken is really a very fine person. Mm. And my mother admired her and liked her for
right.
a lot of her virtues. But
right.
He was irritated, disapproved of the way she would say rather unkind things about her.
What did she have in common with Molly Hamilton, actually? Because I wouldn't have thought Molly Hamilton would be your mother's type of person.
No, very strange. I think they were... I think the explanation is that they must have been extremely fond of each other at Newnham.
I see.
But she saw very little of her afterwards.
Mm.
But, well, all I can say is she used to refer to her as my best friend. And then, of course, I think she was very sorry for Molly Hamilton after her husband. I don't know, I think he had VD or something. But anyway,
there was something unhappy, I know.
Yes, anyway, they separated and it was unhappy. And she was the innocent party.
Mm.
But we saw very little of her, but she occasionally came here. And was a very bright
circle of friends that used to come every year, Marley and Lady Daniel and
Yes.
A number of her, we used to call them rather latterly anyway, lame ducks, either on their own or, but she, it was an annual occurrence and they would come.
Really, at regular time.
There was a distinguished woman, LCC, I think Molly Hamilton was in the LCC, wasn't she?
I think probably so, yes.
And then there was another one, rather Bentwich, strange creature, Dorothy Shapra.
Oh, yes, I've heard of her name, yes.
I can just remember her. Mm. And then another very amusing and intelligent friend of my mother.
Oh, yes, I've met her.
Mildred Ransom.
Yes. Yes.
Who founded the Ransom's Secretarial College. Mm. She was an amusing old thing too. And when she became crippled and in pain and that, and I think was in some kind of a nursing home in Brighton or somewhere down there, my mother used to visit her. I remember my mother being very angry and upset because Mildred Ransom had got very ill and then had been, her life had been saved by some young doctor giving her oxygen. Mm. It was after the poor old thing had to die twice, as it were.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember my mother virtually extracting a promise from me that we would never give her oxygen.
Mm.
Unfortunately, I was never faced with that. Dilemma. I don't think I would have done because by the time she was 99 and she was telling everyone she didn't want to live, I mean, she would have been, unless she had, she been unconscious, she would, I mean, she would never have forgiven me if she'd found out afterwards that we had.
She's your mother's a country person, isn't she, really?
Not, yes.
I mean, one doesn't feel she's happy in an urban context really much at all.
No, I think she was perfectly happy to have her early married life with a young barrister husband and all that sort of thing. And of course, we lived very happily in Putney right through until 1936. And for a time, this was the country cottage. Mm. And I think we bought this in 36 and they enlarged it a bit. And the parents, I would have said, didn't really leave it, leave Putney until about 1940. Certainly they were mainly in London during the Phoney War, because I was at hospital. I was still a student at the London Hospital right up until 1930, till the first week of the war.
Mm.
Living at Putney. So I would have said, in fact, now it's all crystallizing in my mind, my parents were living in Putney and with this as a weekend country, not much more than cottage, right up until the first Blitz, really.
Because it was a middle-class thing to have a country cottage, of course, wasn't it,
yes.
In the 30s and so on. I mean, Eva Hubbock did the same, and so she'd be quite normal in that, her class. But
I gather that when her sister built a house just in the next, half a mile away, within the next plot, given to her by her father, the plot was given, I mean, she built a house there. But this was on her marriage, wasn't it, when Aunt Sisley built that house? They lived there for years. And when this
house... They built Newnham's Rough, I would have said, in about 1930 or 32.
Well, anyway, because she was there, because the family home, which had been sold by that time, because the brother Adrian was killed, and was rebought by the Millers.
Actually, if I could just interrupt you, how was he killed? You mentioned...
Adrian, I'm not quite sure of the connection, but... About a fortnight, or possibly a little more, he'd had a nasty fall hunting and had broken several ribs. Mm. So the presumption is he was a little bit vulnerable, disabled, or whatever. But in fact, he got something wrong with his ear.
I see.
and then developed septicemia.
I see. So, sorry.
It was all pretty devastating because he was he'd not been in the war in the sense that he'd joined the army, but was then put into reserve occupation because he was so able that and he was a very very clever businessman, and he was doing in the munitions business. I mean, organising it, not manufacturing it. And so he was never allowed to go out to the front. But he was an enormously healthy man.
1940 then,
was it? Really, 36.
Was it?
He died while I was at Oxford.
Anyway, you were talking about the house down the road. I interrupted you.
Yes, well, it was only that this house happened to come up for sale my mother-in-law, who was living in
Putney. Yes, I think I did tell you all this.
That's right, you did.
Yes, I did tell the story of that.
You're right.
Sicily said that she was so keen that we should have it, that she even
would have bought
threatened
anyway,
to buy it so that if we were dithering, to prevent somebody else buying it.
Right.
I'm sorry, glad that they took that line.
Yes.
Marky, we'd never been here, you see, and whereas they living next door knew what a nice little place and beautiful view and all that.
But your mother, for instance, would never rush down to London to the theatre, or, I mean, she never pined for London the way that some people
do. No, I would have thought that they virtually never went to the theatre. Certainly no cinema.
Well, presumably she'd go to musical occasions because your father would go. But I mean,
yes, she might. She would probably go with him to hear the Christmas Oratorio in St. Paul's.
Mm.
But after he died, I think a little bit in memory of him, she went regularly to the there's a big do in St. Paul's, that, as Pam says, at Christmas and Easter, the Messiah or the Bach Christmas Oratorio,
or one
of the big religious
things,
and she went to that and enjoyed it. I mean, it is pretty wonderful music. But she was, but it was always rather, that they said this in, she used to say this in a comic way, that father's ambition had always been to marry a blonde pianist. And in the end, he married a brunette who was hopeless at the piano.
She had a super sense of humour. Actually, a sort of wry sense of humour, very, very distinctive. Well, I must relieve you of my presence. But is there anything else either of you feel about her that we haven't talked about that's important? I mean, you know, one only sort of makes a number of shots, and I may well not have hit perhaps even the most crucial mark. I mean, is there anything about her you'd want to emphasise, really, that we haven't talked about?
No, I'm always rather keen to tell you about the two psychic things, because I think I regard them as rather prime evidence, do you see, but of something which really didn't impinge on her in the sense that it had no influence on her life at all.
Because one of the attractive things about her as a prominent feminist between the wars is that she wasn't at all masculine. I mean, so many of these women, even somebody like Ray Strachey or even Lady Stocks, I suppose, they were rather masculine.
Yes, yes, yes.
And
yes.
She was always very feminine.
Yes.
And that's really, I think, one reason why she was
a very good grip on sort of feminine things. She was a very good embroideress.
Right, yes.
And she did a lot of, she was never without something, tapestry or patchwork or something.
Right.
Pick up, so
she was very good. She did a lot. She knitted, and I mean, she wasn't a tremendously skilled knitter, in that she wouldn't have attempted a sort of thing like that, but she did ordinary straightforward knitting.
She liked to have
socks
and
pullovers and that.
No.
That
would fit with everything else.
If she was talking, she would be crocheting or something like that.
And your thing about taxes, you see, that's, I'm absolutely like that. An awful lot of middle class people are. They will not take taxes if they can possibly avoid it. And it's not meanness, because they would take a taxi if they were taking an old person somewhere or something.
Oh, yes.
It's just that for yourself, you always get a bus if you possibly can.
Yes.
It's a characteristic middle class trait.
She
trained.
Never travelled first class. She disliked the idea of having to travel first class.
Right.
What's the matter with her?
Mm.
And of course, neither she nor, strangely enough, her relatively much more wealthy parents had any real idea of comfort. I mean, the furniture in the old family home at Woodgate was really pretty damn uncomfortable.
And the chair.
It was a great joke among all her friends, all their friends.
And the chair that she sat in that your father had was a bit tatty, wasn't it?
Yes.
And she was rather conscious of that, though. I mean, she kept on saying to us, we must put something over the arm or something, as in fact I'm beginning to feel with that sofa now.
Well, I don't think she'd have
same
any
sort of thing. But I think there was not so much meanness as, well, it's only got to last my lifetime.
Right.
I know she felt towards the end very much that she didn't want to spend a penny more than she needed just to get her through. So
right,
that meant for everything, clothing, things that she used, and a lot.
I think they had a rather strong sort of moral sense that although it was all very well to, you know, spend reasonable money on your food and drink, with so much want in the world, to waste was a bad thing. I don't think she was as screwy about waste as her mother was, or indeed sometimes as I am, but, you know, go to great lengths in order to save. Her mother once, when the upstairs, there was a huge house and a great long upstairs corridor, the centre of the carpet began to get worn, and her friends and relations were staggered to come to her house one day and find that she'd cut this carpet from end to end down the middle and had turned the two. Tell you what it was like. So there was a sort of double thickness of dark red Indian border, and then the sort of warmness of the
Did she enjoy life, do you think?
My mother, oh, immensely, had tremendous zest for the whole of her life, yes. Vastly so.
Sometimes when people are either at risk of dying or near the end of their lives, they tell you. They say, I've had a good life or not a good life or whatever. Did she ever say anything along those lines?
Oh, yes, I think I can't remember her positively saying it, but it was certainly her attitude that she'd had a wonderful life, and I think she really said so and certainly thought so, and indeed she had. Mm. I mean, apart from the dreadful agonies of 1916, when sort of I was at death's door and father was in the trenches, and then a shorter, less traumatic but pretty distressing period of at the disarmament conference.
Oh,
look, there was one thing, yes, I knew there was something else. Would you like a quick sketch of this business of the Czech refugees?
Oh, yes, I want to. Yes, I would actually, because the war in general we haven't said much about. If you've got the time.
Yes. Well, as I say, we're
now 3:43.
In any case, we just. I can't. I'm trying to roll a patch of lawn for my aeroplanes in the field. What? There was. Of course, the parents were very upset by the Munich crisis, and although my mother was a very keen pacifist in the sensible way, she actually felt that Britain and France should have stood up and been prepared to turn up the heat and resist Hitler. I think probably that she was wrong, but at any rate, they were very upset by Munich, and then just apparently the world, or anyway, people in the know, knew that Hitler was about to invade Czechoslovakia, and literally 2 or 3 days before he did, Lord Leighton, whom I've already mentioned, and 2 other men, and I don't remember who they were, but really we ought to try and find out, dashed out to Prague and brought back a dozen or so people who were literally on the Nazi and Sudeten German death list, among whom was a Jewish radiologist called Emil Ungar, who had a very nice looking ash blonde wife.
How do you spell that? Emil what? How do you spell
E-M-I-L, that? Emil, and then Ungar, U-N-G-A-R.
Mm-hmm.
Any rate, so Leighton and company arrived in London with these poor wretched people who'd come with little more than they were standing up in. I don't think they weren't able to bring much in the way of money out, if anything at all. And I mean, they'd literally had to drop everything and fly for their lives. And I suppose, naturally, Leighton rang up my parents and asked if they would have. So Dr. Ungar came and stayed with us. And I remember my parents saying to me after he'd been with us some months, look, do you mind this person living with us? And I at once said, no, please have my head. Happy and friendly relations with him, he was a nice old chap. And then some time later, actually I managed to buy a lot of very good photographic equipment through him. This wasn't because I said he could, I mean this was some time later, but he had friends out there who were desperately trying to get money out. It was quite impossible. What they could do was to buy photographic equipment out there, and come to England, and then we in England would pay for it in England and deposit the money so that at least they could get, but you know, there was a sort of 4-to-1 advantage on it, and I bought on simply a lot of, I wasn't doing anybody down, but I simply was able to buy 4 times as much as I would have done otherwise. Anyway, and then at some time later, and I can't remember when, and it doesn't matter, his wife was able to get out because she was ash blonde and not obviously Jewish. She was able to get out, and they came and they lived. Both of them lived together in my parents' and the Putney house. I know I said there were 6 bedrooms, but nevertheless it was only the downstairs. It was only the dining room and the drawing room.
How long were they living there, actually, roughly?
I think they were with us for over 2 years, which I think says a lot for my parents' tolerance. And
what about people she had here during the war, after she left Putney? She had people staying here, didn't she, as well, you were mentioning earlier?
Yes.
Yes.
She had Uncle George, she had the 2 maids and their father in the house.
Mm.
The Ungars by that time had left. The Ungars had by that time left. He'd got a good job. He'd got a good job in the radiology department of the Royal Cancer Hospital, as it was in those days, and I think was earning by then quite a decent salary as a senior radiologist. And his wife was a skilled radiographer, and of course there was a shortage of people during the war. So I think they were both, by the time they were both earning, they were able to get their own flat in Kensington and left us. But we were very fond of her.
This is a characteristic generally of her that she would, I think your wife was saying, she would tend to invite people almost at random to stay. As though she still lived in a country house, almost.
Yes, I mean, well, this was, of course,
of course,
a slight cause of
not the random
trouble, slight embarrassment to poor Pamela. So, oh, do come to lunch, or do come and stay the night, and all that sort of thing.
Yes.
Which, of course, when you had maids.
But she'd been open-hearted to any all her life like that.
Yes, and to the extent of even being imposed upon sometimes.
Oh, I'm sure.
Oh, yes,
I'm sure, but I
don't,
can't think of the moment.
My
recollection is that she really wasn't really imposed on much.
No,
it depends on how you look at it.
£25 loan.
I mean, nearly all these people were worth helping.
Anyway, I'm sure she'd say, well, it doesn't matter if they weren't. You faced up to the challenge you were given.
Yes.
Yes, I think her one, I remember her being very disappointed in a way that these 2 Czech people, who she got very fond of, went back at the end of the war to Czechoslovakia because she hadn't realised that they were both communists, weren't they?
Well, no, I don't think that's quite right. No,
not
I don't think that's quite the right way of putting it. He, as a very, very young doctor, I think, had served in the Russian army, but of course when it had invaded Austria, yeah, I'm a bit rocky about the Middle Eastern part of the First World War. Anyway, he'd had some connection with Russia and had always admired Russia, mm-hmm. and I suppose to some extent was a communist, I don't think a party card one, and he had none of the brutal philosophies of a communist. He was much more an early Christian type of communist. But as Pam said, the tragedy was that after the war, he had this very well-paid, secure job, and because I think he would have probably been made a radiology consultant, because he was very good and experienced, and his wife could have gone on working because they had no children. But when Czechoslovakia wanted rebuilding, I remember having rather an agonized talk with him, and he said that he felt he must go back. And of course he went back, but not at once, but tragically soon, of course, Czechoslovakia was taken over by more and more actively Stalinist people. And then, of course, reached the ghastly and almost incredible situation, to my mind, mind-boggling, where they would actually turn against someone like Ungar because they'd been in Britain, entirely oblivious of the fact that Britain had been fighting with Russia against the hated Germans. But of course, these communists have this most wonderful power of turning things upside down. So really, they lived rather a tragic life. I mean, he was sort of tolerated, but no question of promotion or being made head of the radiology department, and it was all pretty bit grim. But they survived without a car, but a little flat.
Was it difficult for you, Mrs. Ashby, really? I mean, I think your position, actually, as I said before, was potentially very difficult in the situation. Was it difficult for you always living in her shadow, really, as a woman?
I didn't feel it that way at all. Because
your spheres were different.
Our shadows were so far apart.
Quite, yes. So you could both tolerate each other.
She respected my side of whatever I was doing.
Yes.
And I had great admiration of hers. Mm. I don't think in any way...
I think the difficulty which both of them coped with admirably was really after we sold our London flat and this house quite some time before, entirely at my wish, had been made over to Pam so that she was totally the owner of it. I think Pam rather, it was a little difficult for her knowing that this was her house and after we had no other home. But yet equally it was my mother's house, de facto. So here were two people, two women each, owning the same house, and they both dealt with it admirably, but it caused, I think, both of them a certain amount of and understandable embarrassment.
I entirely understand, yes.
But there were never any words or anything like
that. I think it suited her very well. I think I must have said, so long as you keep out of the kitchen, I shan't mind. She didn't want to go to the kitchen.
In practice it worked marvellously. Well. If you say, was it a difficult situation?
It could have been.
I think it's probably a better way of putting it, that it was potentially a difficult situation which both parties dealt with admirable tact and understanding.
Right, I think that's right. Anyway, let me switch off, but let me just ask when I have switched off.
It is still going.
It's still going, yeah.